joy to see some who haven't been here for a while. And it's a joy to see those who live here and those who are long-term visitors and those who have just arrived. So a special welcome if you are in that last category. And I hope that you have been made comfortable here and that you have come to the ashram with the appropriate yearning in the soul. Because if you have the same yearning that is the mission of an ashram, then you will be in total sync with everything that is happening. And there will be perfect harmony in your heart. And an ashram is simply a place where egos come to die. So that we may live in bliss rather than in suffering. Since the ego illusion is the only obstacle. But the ego puts up quite a fight, and so therefore it requires tremendous spiritual heroism to achieve the goal of transcendence of the ego in order to become again realized as the one absolute, true, and real self. But since that is what we are, it is also our destiny to attain that goal. And the will of God and the grace of that supreme intelligence is always guiding us. Even in those moments when we may feel forsaken, those are the moments when we are learning the most and being given the opportunity to let go of the most tenacious obstacles of usually attachment, clinging, based on fear of abandonment, fear of aloneness, fear of the unknown, fear of the infinite, fear of that beyond of the event horizon of life and death, which is the abode of the self. So we're beginning a retreat, and it's very good that you have all come with the understanding of what this process is about and what it requires of us. And I'm sure that must be true for all of the online Sangha on the Love Stream. I wish to give a special greeting to all of you as well. It's very much appreciated that we are able to touch the hearts and minds of beings who are seeking the real self, because the world is in desperate need of self-realized beings, because only such beings can bring love back into the world. And the power to redream the world. So, spiritual heroism is your true nature. The archetype of Hanuman is being activated in your heart. That's the subtitle of the retreat. We've chosen Hanuman in particular as one of the archetypal images of the spiritual hero from very ancient times. And this is the holiday that celebrates Hanuman Jayanti, or the birth of Hanuman in India. And during this month is also the holiday of Ram Navami, which is a longer holiday in which the whole charitra, the life story of Rama, is played out. The Ramayana is turned into a play and performed all over India, and the story is told and retold as it has been for thousands of years. And it's a very powerful story. It's the first teaching story that is known to human history in Kali Yuga. I don't think there's any earlier. It's way before Gilgamesh or Beowulf or the Iliad and the Odyssey or any of those other tales that we are probably more familiar with. But it is a teaching tale that contains many secrets that are specifically intended to be understood now, in the end of days that we are living through. And it was put into the earliest time of this last age of the world, Kali Yuga. And it has configured in a very subtle, secret, but very universal way the whole flow and the structure of history, as I think will be able to be recognized, not because of the story, but because of the information carried in its presentation of the structure of consciousness itself. And so for that reason, I think that its study is extremely relevant to spiritual warriors today who want to have a map of the terrain of consciousness on which they are operating, to understand the space-time coordinates that are teleologically affecting our present from the future, and as well as the specific results of the karma that has led us to this moment. Because the whole world is made of information, and that information is organized into mandalic patterns of intelligence. And we are now at the end of the space-time mandala of this world's process. And as we live through these final days, when we are witnessing in real time the collapse of Western civilization, and Western civilization doesn't seem to want to go down gracefully and admit its bankruptcy and accept the consequences, but instead seems determined to take down everyone else with it. And so we have to understand how the macro politics and the micro politics of the ego are fractally related, because that gives us power over the morphogenic field when we understand the self-similarity of every node of consciousness and the space that is created in the form of life energies and the vortices of energy that may have captured your consciousness within a certain spider web of interconnectivity that has, because of inappropriate and inaccurate identifications, created bondages rather than enhanced the life of freedom and sovereignty, so that the consciousness can grow into its fullest potentialities of blossoming as the self. And it's this blossoming of the real self, the infinite consciousness, within each microcosmic manifestation of itself that is the death of the ego. It's not a death brought about through violence or through some forcible means, but the effortless realization of the greatness of that supernal consciousness that transcends the self and is forever unborn and unidentified with any of the ego's narratives. Those narratives configure the spider web in which one may have been captured. And those narratives produce clinging, weakness, fear of growth and change and impermanence and death and all of the various phases that we must go through as embodiments of a phenomenal character that is of a temporary nature within the flow of the entirety of the cosmic drama, and recognize that this character that is being played is only the final reiteration of the archetypal image and concept that comes from the mind of God that has been the energy that has created the entire trajectory of one's flow through life after life in an adventurous quest of that which you are. And in each lifetime, the archetype has become slightly more garbled, more vague, more fuzzy, more indeterminate, more internally fractured and split and conflicted with itself. And because of that, there's a yearning to return to the wholeness and the simplicity and the beauty, the purity, the goodness, the love, the sense of peace, security, safety that only the realization of God can bring about. And so as we approach the end, and the energies that have pushed us into the world, the pravriti energies of expansion, of exploration and adventure and discovery, as all of those become ever more exhausted, the nivriti energies of the infolding back into the core of the self take over. And there's a process of packing up, of withdrawing, of leaving behind that which can no longer mystify and fascinate the mind, but now creates only the dregs of a kind of a disgust and a loss of faith in the reality of anything that the world offers, because it has no reality. And there is a yearning in the heart for what is real and what transcends the momentary. There is a yearning for the eternal and for the complete letting go of that mental apparatus whose endless mental chatter creates constant distraction and dissipation and chaos and a loss of coherence and a desire to return to the center, the core, the nucleus of our being, where that eternal power and light and love and inherent truthfulness still abides. How many feel that? How many of you are here in order to feel that? Yes, good. because it is your birthright. It is your absolute right to self-realization. If you want it, if you're willing to pay the price of the derealization of the false. It really is that simple. So the story of the Ramayana on one level is the story of faithfulness. I think that's the first theme that we need to approach. Faithfulness to the real self and the faithfulness of the self, both. But first there must be, if one is feeling separated from the self, even if one is feeling a lack of faith that there is a self, if one is cut off or one is feeling so eclipsed, so lost in darkness and in confusion and in mental chaos that one can't feel even a glimpse of that supreme presence, then more effort must be made to open the third eye to be able to perceive what is real. But when there is faithfulness to the self, that means there is love. There is an inherent loyalty, a loyalty to the real self that transcends all other worldly loyalties. And if we haven't made that shift in our values so that the self, or if you wish to call it God or the Buddha nature or Brahman or the Tao or Wuji, or take any term that you wish that's a final term of any of the traditional approaches to the real. We're not interested in getting bogged down in terminology, but if there is that faithfulness, then it's very easy to feel the current of Shakti that connects us, that connects the body-mind to the soul and the soul to the infinite self. And that current of energy, of Shakti, enlivens the kundalini, the flow of the energy in the body, and opens up the channels of the prana or the chi and allows the body to become fully alive. And it allows the consciousness, the mind, to become fully vibrant and present and able to sustain its concentration. And able to feel the peace of a presence that transcends the understanding. So as we will discover when we begin to explore the Ramayana, this epic poem that has been written down and rewritten by many different poets and sages and philosophers, and there are many different versions of this. But before it was ever written down, it seems that for at least 1,000 years or so, it was passed on orally by the sages to their disciples, and that this teaching story was studied in its most, let's say, basic core form, as the structure of understanding reality. But if we look at the hero Rama, we will see that he has much in common with the heroic figures of a later epic in India, the Mahabharata, from which we usually, most of us know at least the extract called the Bhagavad Gita. And the hero of the Bhagavad Gita is one of the heroes. There are five Pandava warriors, brothers, and their guru, Sri Krishna. And Krishna is, in a sense, the field marshal in the great battle between the forces of light and dark. And Arjun is a famous archer. In fact, we get the word archery from Arjun and the arcing of the arrow and the arc of the bow. So there's an important element to archery as a metaphor, because Rama, the hero of this much earlier epic that we'll be studying, is also a great archer. Now, what's important about archery is it takes great concentration and great intelligence, because unlike a gun, it doesn't shoot straight. You have to really understand how high you have to aim in order for the arrow to come down upon the target to hit the bullseye. And it is it takes an extraordinary capacity to ballistically analyze its trajectory of flight, and to have the concentration and the stillness to be able to reach the aim and bring it back to the ultimate potentiality of its power, and to let go at the moment when there are no obstacles of wind or anything else, so that the target is struck in the bullseye. And so all of the great heroes of the epics are great archers. So this is the first metaphor that we must understand. An ashram is an archery school, but of a very specific kind of archery. And I was remembering, and I give thanks to those who came up with a copy of this book that we studied years ago, The Yoga of the Bhagavad Gita by Sri Krishna Prem, a very famous mystic. And of course you see the bow and arrow on the cover, right? So, and on the first page of this, there is a quote from the Mundaka Upanishad, from, if you wish, chapter 2 and verse 3 and 4. But I will read it as it appears here in English translation. Having taken as a bow the great weapon of the secret teaching, one should fix in it the arrow sharpened by constant meditation, drawing it with a mind filled with that, tat, meaning Brahman, the ultimate self. Drawing it with a mind filled with that power of the self, penetrate, O youth, that imperishable as the mark. The pranava, the om mantra, is the bow. In other words, the om contains the understanding of the entirety of the cycle of time and the spectrum of consciousness. So that understanding is the bow, the arrow is the self, Brahman is said to be the mark. So by self meaning Atman, with heedfulness is it to be penetrated. One should become one with it as the arrow in the mark. So, in other words, what an archer is to the teaching stories of ancient India is a yogi whose capacity to concentrate and penetrate through the illusion of the ego mind all the way to the bullseye of the core of Brahman, the infinite self. This is the practice of yoga. And this has always been the practice and the purpose. So this must be our practice in this retreat. Each of us must become like Rama, a great archer whose capacity to concentrate and not only hit the mark of the union of Atman and Brahman, the individual self and the infinite self, but the arrow must stick and remain in that union. So this is the practice, and a good archer will hit the mark with a single arrow. So this is the practice. Now the story of the Ramayana, how many of you know the story or have some sense of the plot line? There's a few, okay. You probably know that there is a moment in which Rama's consort, his wife, Sita, is captured by the evil villain Ravana and taken to his fortress city of Lanka, which is an island off of India. And so the capture of the soul, which happens in the middle of the Ramayana, is actually the place where most of us need to begin the story, because our soul may have been already captured. And therefore, our work must be to free it. So there is already a kind of a recognition that we are in medias res, as they say in literary terms. We're in the middle of the Ramayana. We're living it. And most of us need to become Hanuman and free the soul from its captured state. And it will require the great spiritual warriorship of heroes on this journey to accomplish it. So I was reading another book by Sri Krishna Prem today, and I happened to open up at random to a quote by a woman teacher in India, and I want to read it because I think it expresses this very well. I tell you, there is an ocean of bliss that is pent up in your soul. Even if one of its stray breakers should someday waft its message to your mind, then beside its tremendous reality, this world would flicker away before you like a shadow dance. And even this body, which you cherish as the most treasured possession, would dwindle into a husk. And yet it is for just such an ephemeral thing that we fools fight so frantically, missing the only thing that matters, the light of the soul within. I have seen this soul of ours as a blue bird of beauty and bliss, held captive in the body's cage, and yet isn't affected by it
at all.
Yes, the Gita hasn't told us a fairy tale when it assures us that nothing on earth can burn, mutilate, or whittle it down. In the last analysis, we cherish the body for the sake of the Lord who ensouls it. It is He who makes it so lovable. Only we don't know this till we find Him, and until He claims us for His own. And when we are one with Him, we find that everything drips honey, because all that we sense, feel, or perceive is God Himself. There is nothing in this world that stands by itself apart from Him, and none dearer than His beloved self. Once you know Him as the most beloved, do you need to be told to treasure Him or meditate on Him or sing His name? No, you won't be able then to sing of anything else or to do without that presence for a single moment. So that's the state that you are approaching as you practice yoga and hit that target. It activates the inherent blissful ecstasy of the heart as it is freed like a bird out of its cage and is finally able to fly in the full sovereignty of its divine nature. And your soul will fly directly into the arms of God. So this is why we have come, and what we are here to accomplish before we go. And that is the way that we can go without having to return. There's one more quote I want to read you tonight by Sri Ramana, who gives an even more, let's say, non-dual perspective on the reality that will unfold for you once the mark has been hit. So a questioner is asking Sri Ramana, does the sage use occult powers for making others realize the self? Or is the mere fact of self-realization enough for that? Ramana says, the force of self-realization is far more powerful than the use of all other powers. This is, I think, a very important point, because there are those who want to develop certain kinds of siddhis, certain kinds of paranormal abilities, but it is this ultimate realization that contains the power of all others combined. Ramana continues, inasmuch as there is no ego in the sage who has realized, there are not others for him. What is the highest benefit that can be conferred on others? It is happiness. Happiness is born of peace. Peace can reign only when there is no disturbance. Disturbance is due to thoughts which arise in the mind. When the mind itself is absent, there will be perfect peace. Unless a person had annihilated his mind, he cannot gain peace and be happy. Unless he himself is happy, he cannot bestow happiness on others. Where there is no mind, he cannot be aware of others. So the mere fact of self-realization is itself enough to make all others happy, because those others are not different from the self, and the self is bliss. So, the annihilation of the mind, how does that happen? The mind we're speaking of course, is the limited relative mind of the ego that's based on the false identification of consciousness with the body. And so its thoughts are caught up in an egocentric mesh of desire to fulfill bodily wants and a sense of a creation of a space for the body's comfort. And everything is organized around how the body-mind can make itself most free and buffered from the traumatic invasions of real one, of the real, of the phenomenal plane. And its attempts to achieve happiness through such external means are always doomed to failure. They can only be temporary at best. But if the consciousness is abiding in the unchanging awareness of the realization there is only the God Self and no others, then there can be no invasion and no attack, and therefore there's no paranoia, and therefore the mind is in a state of metanoia, the state of absolute, profound, blissful union with the Supreme Intelligence and the Supreme Love. And so the mind, the annihilation of the mind is a byproduct of hitting the mark of the real self. It's not something that has to be striven for. It happens effortlessly through the shift of the consciousness from desire to love. Because desire always brings fear. But the word love is not to be understood in duality as an I love you, because there are no others and there is no I. It is love itself, the energy of love itself, that may or may not produce the illusion of objects of love. But love itself has no object and no subject. It is the pure emanation of the energy of the self. And thus the love is unconditional and undifferentiating. And in that state, there is no fear. And in the state of fearless love, one can endure whatever the world can bring on, and can endure the loss of that world or anything in it. Because nothing real can be lost, and there is nothing to gain that is not already part of your being. because the self is the whole. So that's the macro story in a nutshell, and I think by going into the nuances of the unfoldment of the logic of the plot, we will be able to see our own internal structure mapped out for us, so that what has become fragmented can be reunified at the highest level of coherence and of redemption of that core of being that contains all that is valuable in life, because it is immortal and eternal, and it is all that we are able to keep when the body must be dropped and the consciousness enters into the infinite realm in which nothing can be even illusorily controlled. And so if we are able to surrender to the goodness of that supreme power, that pearl of great price, that diamond of consciousness that brings the ultimate power of coherence and goodness, then we have the freedom to live in nobility and to plant the seeds of the world that will follow the death of this age. So, we still have about half an hour. I'm going to open the floor. I think the microphone is set up. If anyone here has a question, please feel free to go to the mic and you'll be called on. And if there are any online, Purusha will let us know about that. Do you want to say anything about our online attendees?
Absolutely. We don't have any questions just yet, but we want to welcome everyone who's joining us online. We have people joining in from the Netherlands, the U.S., Germany, Ethiopia, Portugal, Canada, Sweden, and Brazil, and we're very happy to have you all with us for the retreat.
Okay. So, I want to emphasize to the new visitors that you shouldn't be shy here, and there are no questions too elementary, and it's an opportunity to clear any doubts and to clarify any points that may be obstacles in your meditation. And so I hope that everyone will feel uninhibited and free to ask whatever in your heart may enable a clearing of some kind of obscuration.
Thank you so much, Shunya. Really appreciate the opportunity to explore this mythology more deeply with you. And I have a question that came up recently about cutting attachments. And what I was reflecting upon was this idea of like the cutting of the attachment being this kind of black and white if I feel attached to something, I need to let go of it. I need to get rid of it. I need to be free from it. But it feels like whenever I've gone through the process of overcoming an addiction or letting go of an addiction, it seemed like there was this process of trying to quit or trying to let it go, and it never really working until this moment where it's just ready to drop away, and then it just falls away naturally. Mm-hmm. But I guess where it led me was to think about the level from which I'm relating to the attachment. Like, who is it that I think I am that's attached to something, and who is it that is able to let go of it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, that's the real question, you see. It's the attachment to the false self that's the problem, not the false self's attachment to others, right? It needs to attach to others because it's false, and it needs to get some affirmation that it's not false in order to feel okay and to cover that lack of being. And so the ego will, it can be addicted to something that gives it a psychoactive state, that gives it a thrill of being more alive, or a passionate relationship that stimulates and covers over the depression and the anxiety that are underneath the desire realm. But all of this, because it's based on projections and of an internal lack, the whatever is valuable that is being projected is what you have not claimed about your own reality. And so when you recognize that what you are projecting into an other or into a substance is what you feel that you are lacking within your own being, when you ask, is that my being, or is that a mental object that is lacking, then you will recognize that you are trying to connect two objects. One may be external to the ego consciousness, but both are within consciousness itself. And it's an attempt to create a stable molecule, a stable unity in duality, because it cannot unify itself with its own real nature. And so instead of trying to, you know, reject the object of desire or demand or whatever, the drive, if instead you ask, who am I? Who is this? And why is it feeling this? The real presence of the self that is not identified with the mental apparatus that has that drive will actually release the desire to grasp in order to feel whole, and will enable a graceful letting go that doesn't require a rejection, because all are part of the self. It will shift desire simply into love and acceptance. But there won't be any need to make some kind of a break that is a rupture between beings or friendships or any kind of relationship externally, but a shift in the nature of that relationship from egos clinging because of fear of lack and abandonment to manifestations of the one self that can freely relate and not relate, but without any traumatic sense of loss or of desire for gain, but a pure generosity of spirit that gives, but that gives unconditionally to all. So it is a shift from being a creature of lack to a fullness that overflows with the power of love. I think that's the way that addictions need to be overcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the question.
Okay, we have a question from Prema, who asks, or who says, I appreciate that you are beginning to delve in the plot in medias res and the context that you're providing for it. What are the dates we are looking at as the origins of this tale?
Well, it's unknown. It goes back at least to 3 to 5,000 BC, but because it was transmitted orally for many generations before it was ever written down, its origin really can't be pinpointed historically. But probably the first writing was maybe, I think, around 1,000 or so BC. The version that most people read now by Valmiki came much later. I have to recall what the date of that writing is, but it was... was already, I think, into the current era, as it were. Okay.
Okay, a question from Michelle. Is it true? Is it the true self that initiates the process of the dissolving of the ego, or is it the ego that makes the first step?
If the ego seems to take the first step, it's only because the soul has put it into a position where it has to do that, because the ego doesn't really have free will, and it really has an antagonism to its self-annihilation. So if there is an egoic desire of death, it's usually the lower death drive that creates suicidal thoughts rather than thoughts of transcendence and ascension. But if the soul is touching the ego with its light and its intelligence, its discernment, then it can bring about within the ego an aha in which the ego is receiving the soul's insight and download without necessarily recognizing that it actually came from a higher vehicle than its mental apparatus, but that it is being, let's say, infiltrated from the soul level and brought into a different attitude toward the healing of its suffering, in which growth will be able to take place. And I think it's the growth and maturation of the ego that brings it from a primitive level of desire into an aestheticization and a path of ethical development and moral and religious development that wants to create beauty and more meaningfulness and more order and lawfulness and community, let's say, building, community of the organization of humans in a culture in which all can win rather than some having to lose and be oppressed, and to be able to create a sustainable a culture in relation to nature. Those kinds of developments happen, which then will tend to lead to ever more altruism and generosity, and the soul's sovereignty will then take over and bring one to the higher levels of attainment of consciousness, in which one wants one's whole life to have been a blessing for the world, and to be able to leave it and face God with dignity and with a sense of having fulfilled one's mission. And that brings a kind of a heroic willingness then to sacrifice all traces of any egoic remnants of let's say the paranoid, schizoid, depressive, and anxious tendencies that may remain in the subconscious from childhood traumas, and a complete purification of the entire consciousness, so that it can become a container of the infinite light, and then the final liberation attained. So it often will go in steps like that of growth and appreciation of ever more metaphysical levels of love and of consciousness. Okay, Kalyan.
Thank you. I very much appreciated this opening class, the retreat.
Thank you.
Something shifted when, at the very beginning of the class in the guided meditation, you were asking questions and speaking around the theme of energies. Mm. And I realized in that moment that it's not something I'm usually paying attention to. Mm. And when you said, who is containing those energies? Mm. It was like a reset button was pressed for... Mm-hmm. That's how I perceived it. And it was a very refreshing feeling. Mm-hmm. And I realized that it was more of a remembrance. It was it brought in ideas and understandings that when that reset button was pressed, let's say, mm-hmm. it was like wiping a clean slate and then going back to the basic program of the things that we know from being here and listening to the teachings for years, and that we I just wanted to express that feeling at the beginning, the very beginning of the class, of that reset. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking about the energies. And I was thinking about the day and what I thought were energies. I was more thinking about, I would probably say there were more emotions or feeling states that I was labeling as energies, but I don't know. I'm sure there's energies within those as well. Mm-hmm. But it kind of brought a question of what are energies? What are the differences in energies versus emotions versus feelings? And it wasn't until you said, allow the I think you said the self to be absorbed into the self, and that's when that was realized, where there was a difference of energy versus emotion versus feeling states. Mm-hmm. And it was the difference of when I could start to allow, let's say, that absorption to happen, there was much more silence and the chatter was going away, and I thought, oh, those were just feelings. I labeled something as boredom, let's say, or an energy of tiredness, or whatever. These were all just words and labels, but I don't know if I would consider that necessarily an energy, and there's probably many states of that. So I just wanted to express that and maybe ask if you can speak about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think they all are energies, but of different categories and types. So, you know, you have pranic energy, for example, that's bioelectromagnetic energy, and it generally doesn't come with thoughts and labels, but you can just feel it moving through the body, or stuck, or atrophied even, but it, there will be a sense of the flow of the vital life energies in the body. And then there are the physical chemical energies that you can feel that are much grosser, right? And then you get the mental and emotional energies are more subtle, and you can feel how a depressive energy can feel very heavy, or there can be a manic energy that can begin to feel euphoric or by creating an illusion, a fantasy of some way to leap out of a depressive state, and it's a reactive energy. So you can feel how the energies are either bondaged or are creating a bondage or are liberating, and then the more subtle energies of the soul of love and energies of the coherent understanding of the real, the Tao as an energy that is an intuitive knowing, can also be felt at those very subtle levels if the mind is free of the interference patterns of the lower energies. But I think they're all energy, because there's no matter. Matter is convertible into energy, according to Einstein, and that seems to be accurate. But those are quantitative energies, and what we're dealing with in consciousness are qualitative energies that the physicists haven't yet really recognized. But it's those qualitative energies then that produce the effects of the quantitative world that are reflecting back to us a picture of that internal mandala of energies that produces a kind of cymatic structure. You know, like if you have sound energy and you put sand on a plate, it will produce a mandala that will vary according to the sound wave and frequency, etc. So we are always putting out a certain kind of frequency or set of frequencies that either will produce that coherent structure or something anomalous and somehow lacking equilibrium and beauty and seeming to have lax, missing aspects, so dots can't be connected and things remain chaotic. So if you can realize the self, it makes all of the energies orderly again and coherent.
Thank you. That really helps. Now I understand a little bit more what was kind of not coherent, and I was trying to understand in that moment. And the reset was like a feeling of more of a removal of these the chatter and of these stuck type energies that could then be seen of the subtler energies that are, let's say, more associated with silence and bliss and love and these much more beautiful energies that are, I feel they're always there. You just we don't see them. You say this all the time.
Yes.
And so that reset was so needed because I felt very stuck in a very phenomenal egoic mind. Mm-hmm. And when that can be removed.
Yeah. You removed it very easily.
There's something else there.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you. Right.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I hope you'll continue to do the reset until it's your natural state. Okay. Thank you. Okay, Parish.
Okay, a question from one of our pragyanis, Igor. Mm-hmm. He says, I've identified myself in the presence many times, but I still haven't been able to fully let go. How to find that courage to melt the ego in presence?
Well, it's the soul that has to melt the ego. And so when soul consciousness has supervened and the ego is reduced to a mental object that's producing thoughts and emotions, but you're not identified with it, then it no longer has the power to capture you. And you can refuse to entertain what is a very boring display of mental chatter, rather than being fully taken on a ride by it. And the more that the soul turns toward its own source, then that soul vehicle itself dissolves into the infinite light of which it is a ray. And that light washes away all the mental objects. And then it happens spontaneously, effortlessly, that the ego simply is gone because it never really existed. And once the chatter is silenced, it really is a complete non-entity. And if it's not reactivated because there's no more interest in it, and it has become obsolete to the present level in which consciousness has attained of its true nature, then you will be in that state of samadhi. That's the natural state that's never ending. Even though thoughts will happen, but they won't happen from an egocentric apparatus and its algorithms, but they'll happen from the buddhi, from the conscious intellect that is able to coherently discern what is needed in a given situation. And then when that has been taken care of, the mind withdraws back into itself in silence. But the self is never disturbed by any of those actions, because they all take place within the context of non-duality.
Okay. Question from Alan, who says, the connection you were talking about towards the beginning, when giving a massage or doing energy work, I feel this. When I return to the quote-unquote real world, I don't feel like I can maintain this. Can you help me with this?
Okay, so if you're saying that when you are giving a massage or body work of whatever kind, that you're not in the real world, what you really mean is you're not in the false world of the ego, because your professional responsibility has enabled you to put the ego aside so that there can be a very concentrated presence to feel those subtle energies that need to be manipulated or modified so that channels of energy can be opened up and flow and knots can be released and all of that. That is part of body work. And that you are in an egoless state when you are doing that work, but as soon as it's over, you go back into the false world of the ego, and then the ego calls that the real world. So there, that's where the error comes in. And if there could be a realization that what you're doing when you're fully present and egoless, that is the real, and the other is an imaginary overlay that brings you back into a false consciousness in which you're no longer fully present, but you're now living in a plane of representations in the mind that will create tendencies and desires that will dissipate the life energies even more, then one can have the presence of mind at that moment when the shift would habitually happen to say, no, this level of consciousness is who I am, not just what I do when I'm doing body work. And that I am-ness of full presence and total egoless awareness will remain a constant state if it is chosen at that moment when that power of choice is present. But it is lost the moment that the shift happens into the ego. And so it is important that you use that oasis of professional work to create an establishment of the self as that egoless presence that then refuses to go back into recessive mode so that the ego can take over again. And then the higher intelligence of the self that is able to function in a concentrated way will now return to the full presence of its own beingness rather than simply the doingness in which it was applied to a situation. And then it simply becomes the consistent plane of consciousness in which the awareness dwells. And that is the real world, the world of consciousness, not that which is projected by the ego as reality. Okay, well, I think we're over time for tonight. Was this first talk useful to people? Yeah, I hope that we set the stage for going deeper into the meaning of this teaching story, but keeping in mind that our goal is to fulfill our full potentiality of spiritual power in this life now. We're not just simply studying literature or interested in knowing the history of the development of Hindu thought or anything like that. We are interested in liberation of our consciousness. And the more that we are able to engage in that archery of hitting the mark of the self and activating the third eye so that we see what is really present, not in terms of the five senses, but of that much more powerful extrasensory perception of the supreme reality of consciousness that is responsible for all of the sensory modalities and saturates them but never appears within them. And once you are in that state where you are at the source of those powers, you are no longer a character in a dream world, but now you have transcended the dream, and as the dreamer, the self-realized intelligence, the effect on the whole morphic field of the dream as a quantum entanglement of every mind into a single network is now accessible and within reach of the cosmic consciousness of your inherent self. And it is that explosion into the cosmic from the particular individual that brings about a liberation from a very cramped and fear-based mode of behavior and of feeling into one of ecstasy and one of a total astonishment of knowledge and of presence that brings the transcendent and the immanent, the eternal and the temporal into unity. And in that state, then, the story of the ego's unfoldment ends, and the cosmic drama reveals its ultimate denouement, the ultimate moment of the unraveling of the great mystery that had always been the object of the vision quest of consciousness, to know itself as one really is. And all of that is instantly revealed as eternal bliss. So this is what we are able to achieve at any moment through the concentration that penetrates through the mind field of the ego and reaches the heart of the absolute intelligence that underlies our entire world that is a projection of our mind. And we'll turn that world from a hell into a heaven. So I hope all of you are prepared for that heavenly transformation that will come about in the macrocosm as well as in the microcosms of all beings. Blessings for that transfiguration. Namaste.